And you remember 2,000 stock symbols, but forget the children's birthdays, there's a good chance you've become too wrapped up in your work. By mid-1990, it finally dawned on me that the job had to go. I remember that my fund's namesake, Ferdinand Magellan, also retired early to a remote island in the Pacific. Although what happened to him afterwards, he was torn to shreds by angry natives, was enough to give me pause. Hoping to avoid a similar fate at the hands of angry shareholders, I met with Ned Johnson, my boss at Fidelity, along with Gary Burkhead, the director of operations, to discuss a smooth exit. Our powwow was straightforward and amicable. Ned Johnson suggested that I stay on as group leader for all the Fidelity equity funds. He offered to give me a smaller fund to operate, one, say, with $100 million in assets, as opposed to the $12 billion with which I had to cope. But even with a couple of the digits knocked off, it seemed to me the new fund would require the same amount of work as the old one, and I'd be back spending Saturdays at the office. I declined Ned's gracious invitation. I've always been skeptical of millionaires who congratulate themselves for walking away from a chance to enrich themselves further. Turning one's back on a fat future paycheck is a luxury that few people can afford. But if you're lucky enough to have been rewarded in life to the degree that I have, there comes a point at which you have to decide whether to become a slave to your net worth by devoting the rest of your life to increasing it, or whether to let what you've accumulated begin to serve you. I've chosen the latter, but with an important qualification. I'm still a stock picker, even though I've rejoined the amateur ranks. I've picked up a few ideas about stocks over the years, some of which have been published previously. What inspires me to retake the pulpit is that a majority in the congregation continues to favor bonds. Obviously, they must have slept through my last sermon, one up on Wall Street, in which I tried to prove once and for all that putting money into stocks is far more profitable than putting it into bonds, certificates of deposit, or money market accounts. Otherwise, why are 90% of the nation's investment dollars still parked in these inferior spots? Throughout the 1980s, which was the second best decade for stocks in modern history, only the 50s was slightly more bountiful. The percentage of household assets invested in stocks declined. This percentage, in fact, has been declining steadily, from nearly 40% in the 1960s to 25% in 1980 to 17% in 1990. As the Dow Jones average and other stock indexes quadrupled in value, a mass of investors was switching out of stocks. Even assets invested in equity mutual funds shrunk from around 70% in 1980 to 43% in 1990. This calamity for the future of individual and national wealth cannot go unchallenged. Let me begin then where I left off the last time. If you hope to have more money tomorrow than you have today, you've got to put a chunk of your assets into stocks. Maybe we're going into a bear market, and for the next 2 years or 3 years or even 5 years, you'll wish you never heard of stocks. But the 20th century is full of bear markets, not to mention recessions. In spite of that, the results are indisputable. Sooner or later, a portfolio of stocks or stock mutual funds will turn out to be a lot more valuable than a portfolio of bonds or CDs or money market funds. There, I've said it again. Let me tell you why I'm repeating myself. In exactly one decade out of the past seven, the 1930s, bonds have outperformed stocks. That means that the odds are 6-1 that a dedicated stock picker will do better than people who stick with bonds. Moreover, the gains enjoyed by the bondholders in the rare decade when bonds beat stocks cannot possibly hope to make up for the huge advantages made by stocks in periods such as the 1940s and the 1960s. Over a seven-decade span from the 1920s to the 1980s, a $100,000 investment in long-term government bonds would now be worth $1.6 million. The same amount invested in the Standard & Poor's 500 would be worth $25.5 million. This leads me to Peter's principle number one. Gentlemen who prefer bonds are making a